We'll learn the skinny behind dits and da's in 5, 4, 3, 2. I'm Larry McClure, KB9DIP, with the March 31st Rain Report Hamcast. Morse code was the bane of many a wannabe ham for years until code was eliminated by the FCC from the entry-level testing program of amateur radio. For the uninitiated, the use of Morse code goes back well over a century. An Indiana man who became a ham way back in 1927 was Lewis Coe, W9CNY. At the turn of the century, in 2000, Rain's Hap Holly, KC9RP, spoke with Lewis about the evolution of this nonverbal language.
How did the whole idea of Morse code come about in the first place?
Well, mainly because they had developed the idea that they could control a magnet at a distance, but they needed some way to transform this into usable communication, and so that was what they did. They finally figured that a dot and a dash could be combined in various ways to represent the alphabet, and that was how they were going to communicate. The idea wasn't exactly original with Morse, because some people in Europe had developed codes too, but Morse is the only one whose idea was ever adopted and used to any extent, but that was the basis for it. They needed some way to transform these magnetic pulses into useful information, so they came up with this code, and they analyzed the English language and discovered that more E's were used than anything else, so they assigned that one dot, the shortest symbol. And there's always been a lot of controversy as to whether it was Morse or Alfred Vail that invented the code, but I think the best guess is that it was a joint effort of the two men, but Vail's ancestors always insisted that he was the one that developed it. So that's how it got started.
What was the background of Samuel Morse?
Samuel Morse was actually a professional artist, a portrait painter. He started out as a painter, and he made several well-known paintings, and he was on a trip to Europe in that connection, and he, on the way home, of course, those days it took about 6 weeks to cross the Atlantic, so they had a lot of time to think about things. And the electricity, of course, this was, in those days, there had been no practical application of electricity whatsoever, but Morse was an educated man, and he'd heard about electricity. And so while he was on this voyage from England to America in 1832, he got the idea that this idea could be used to communicate with, which nobody else really had thought about too much. And by the time he reached New York, he'd had the basic idea in mind, but he didn't have time to work on it right away because he was almost penniless in those days, and he finally got a job with New York University as an art teacher, I think it was, and he used his spare time to develop this experimental telegraph system. And then, of course, he never got anywhere with that until he finally got a grant from Congress to build this line from Washington to Baltimore about 1843 or 44, along in there. He was really just almost destitute when he was at the university. He rented some rooms from the university, and he developed this machine, which was made out of an old canvas stretcher. There's replicas of it in existence. This thing traced lines, the dots and dashes, on a moving paper tape, and for many years, quite a few years at least, while that was, they finally developed some more sophisticated recorders, but they started out with a system of recording the dots and dashes on a paper tape. Eventually, the guys that operated these machines got used to the clicks of the machine and discovered they could read the messages by ear. So about 1850, well, that became the method that was used then for the rest of the life of the Morse telegraph, reading by ear. That was the way it started out. But the line to Baltimore in 1844 was the first practical demonstration, and they were going to put that line underground, but unfortunately the underground cable at that time wasn't any good, and they couldn't make it work, so they finally strung the line on poles, and that set the pattern for the rest of the time. And if the underground experiment had succeeded, it might have changed the whole character of communications. We would have had underground lines in the beginning as we have now, but they just didn't have the adequate facilities for making the cable that would provide underground service.
They didn't have preamps in those days to reamplify a signal over many, many miles. How far did the actual magnetic pulse travel down that wire between Washington and, was it Baltimore, you said?
Yeah. Well, I forget what the actual mileage is. I don't suppose it would be more than 100 miles, if that. But it turned out that in actual practice, you could work Morse telegraphy up to about 300 miles. Then as the technology improved, while they developed means of repeaters, which would insert new battery at intervals. So with that, you could go any length you wanted to, and that eventually led to the transcontinental telegraph line, that New York could work San Francisco direct because it had repeaters at intervals, which put on new battery and transmitted the signal.
What were these repeaters like?
They were electromagnetic devices, and the first ones were one-way repeaters. That is, they could only transmit in one direction at a time. But then in the 1860s, while they developed the repeater that was a two-way repeater, and these were fairly complex. They had three or four relays in them, and they were rather intricate in operation, but they could send from east to west. But if west wanted to break east, he could. You know, he could interrupt the sender and so on. The incoming signal, let's say from the east, came into the coil of a relay and operated that relay, and that in turn operated some local circuits and eventually actuated a sending relay that was on the western side of the repeater. So it's a little bit complicated to describe, and it's actually a rather complicated circuit, but it does require an incoming relay and an outgoing relay and then several intermediate instruments. It requires at least two or three sources of power. It doesn't work all on the same batteries, but they had at least two or three sources of battery. And, of course, these things are clicking all the time in response to whatever signal is coming in from one side and going out the other. But even to this day, they're a fairly complicated thing, and for that reason, they were only installed at main points where they had people that were trained to adjust them and get them working right. That made it possible to extend a telegraph circuit any distance, really.
You're listening to a conversation Raines Hap Holly, KC9RP, had with Lewis Coe, W9CNY, an Indiana ham who spent some years studying the evolution of the Morse code. We'll continue Hap and Lou's discussion about the history of dits and dahs in a moment. The Rain Report Hamcast is available on demand on therainreport.com. You can hear this weekly hamcast on shortwave Saturday evenings on WTWW from Lebanon, Tennessee, around 9 o'clock Central Time on 5085 kilohertz. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
Lou, you mentioned the first telegraphic run of wire ran from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore, Maryland. You figure about 100 miles. Was there some effect of capacitance in that magnetic line that degraded or altered the signal between those two points?
Yes, there was. The telegraph wire had capacitance as well as inductance, but this effect wasn't too well understood at first, and some of the first experiments with duplex and printing telegraphs and so on didn't realize the effects of capacity. They thought that by just putting in lumped inductance equal to the line value that they could simulate the operation, but the experiments didn't take capacity into account, and of course it was an important factor. So there was a capacity, and the wire chiefs eventually learned to check for an open wire, they would check it by applying a voltage and seeing how far a voltmeter kicked up scale, roughly measuring the capacity, and it was an important effect, all right. But for simple Morse operation, of course, you didn't have to worry about that. The basic Morse circuits would work up to about 300 miles without any repeaters, and didn't worry about the capacity effect because it didn't enter in, but it was there all right.
One thing I don't understand, how can Morse code have gone 300 miles without any kind of repeaters, if you will, in line, whereas today there's no way that you could convey audio anywhere near that distance without reamplification?
Well, of course, today most of your circuits are in cable, and cable has an even higher capacity per foot than an open wire line, and Morse code basically relied on the simple principles of Ohm's law. What goes in has to come out, less the resistance of the line. And today, why most of your circuits are either in cable or else they're derived from some radio link of some kind, they can compensate for all these various effects. But the simple Morse circuit didn't have to worry about any of those things. All it had to do was have enough voltage to come out at the other end. And they usually used a relay in the line to respond to the line current, and the relay in turn operated a local sounder, so the relay was more sensitive and enables you to work on a very poor line or with very low current. The circuits I worked on with postal telegraph had about 150 volts on the line, and that would get through almost anything. And, of course, a lot of the early lines were very poor, a lot of grounds and so on. But as long as something came out the far end, and, of course, Ohm's law pretty well established that. In the beginning, a lot of electrical engineers thought that electricity wouldn't penetrate a wire for an infinite distance, that it would just peter out, but it never disappears, just always there, except that it gets weaker according to the distance. But the first transatlantic cables were a good example. A lot of people didn't think they would work, but when they went to test the transatlantic cables, why, they had two of them across the Atlantic, and the guy hooked up a test outfit. He had one end joined together, so he had a loop across the Atlantic and back again to Ireland where he was, and he had just a tiny battery, which he improvised on the spot, but it couldn't have been more than a wristwatch battery nowadays, but it was enough to prove the theory that the current was getting through there. And they used very mirror galvanometers to measure the current, of course, and it was very weak, but it was there.
It just boggles my mind, not being an engineer and only dabbling in audio as we know it today, that such a weak signal or a low power signal, literally powered by what amounts to, I guess, a watch battery, in those days, actually would go that far down a cable, 2,500 miles each way, and not have the signal entirely attenuated by the time it reached the other end.
That does seem miraculous, but after you study Ohm's law, why, you realize it can happen, but the current is very weak and takes a very sensitive device to detect it, of course, but it does work. And at that time, a lot of the learned opinion of the day held that it wouldn't work. You know, they didn't think that, they thought electricity would just gradually attenuate it in a long wire and just gradually die out to nothing, but of course it never does. But you got to have the right equipment to detect it, and that was one of the reasons that the Morse telegraph was so successful, because almost any kind of a line, some of the early lines were very poorly built, poorly insulated, some weren't insulated at all, and they could put the battery on there and communicate between two points.
And that concludes the first of two excerpts from a year 2000 conversation Rains Hap Holly, KC9RP, had with Crown Point, Indiana ham, Lewis Cole, W9CNY. We'll learn more about the evolution of Morse code next time. The Rain Report Hamcast is copyright 1990-2018 Rain. All rights are reserved. I'm Larry McGlure, KB9DIP, bidding you a very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, downloadable from therainreport.com and broadcast on shortwave around 9 p.m. Central Time, Saturdays on WTWW from Lebanon, Tennessee, on 5085 kilohertz. Keep on hamming.